We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Conference Finals series still active in the NBA, things heating up in the NHL, a full season ahead of us essentially in Major League Baseball. So make sure you're doing that over at WynnBET. Alex Berutha back on the pod. We're about what, hour and a half, 2 hours from the tip of Game 4 Warriors Mavs. So per usual, we will not be doing a like 1 hour breakdown of a game that is about to happen before at least 90%, if not 95% of listeners even download this episode. But I want to do kind of a series reset. It would feel weird not to address it. First of all, for posterity, are you expecting this series to be over by the time we check in either later tonight or early tomorrow morning?
I wouldn't be surprised, but I do think I think the Mavericks can win this game. Like, backs against the wall. Like, they've proven throughout the other parts of the playoffs. I mean, a game seven against Phoenix was decisive. You know, playing without Doncic during the early portion of the Utah series. Like, I would be kind of surprised if they got swept here, even though obviously the Warriors are amazing, but I feel like the Mavs can pull out a win here.
So I agree with you in that coming into the series, if someone said, do you think the Mavs are going to get swept? I would say absolutely not. No chance. But based on how these first three games have gone, I could kind of see it now. Like, I don't really know if you're the Mavs, like, does this team strike you as the type of team that's going to rally together and say, like, look, we just got to get this one. And then we got to get the next one. And then all of a sudden we win game six, we force game seven. Like, I just don't get that impression from this team. Like, it feels like they knew. I mean, literally every team that's ever gone down 3-0 in NBA history knows that once you lose that third game, there's just no coming back. And look, at some point it's going to happen. We're going to see a comeback like that. But man, I just don't see it. I don't see it. I mean, if they win tonight, I think they probably lose game five. I think most people would agree with that. I think they're catching the Warriors at a uniquely bad time because the Warriors had a chance to close out Memphis in five games, and all of a sudden they were down 55 points and lost that game by, I think, 39. So I feel like the Warriors are on like high alert to avoid another situation like that tonight. I think they're going to be maybe more focused than they normally would to try to close this thing out. And, you know, if you're trying to search for motivation on the Warriors' end, you know, you're looking at a pretty major rest advantage if you close this thing out in four games, you know, over whether it's Boston or Miami coming out. I mean, we got game five of that series in the East on Wednesday. That series will wrap up at the earliest on Friday. So if Golden State wins tonight, you're looking at a minimum of a 3-day advantage in terms of rest. And if that series were to go to a game seven, that would be on Sunday. So at that point, then you're looking at essentially a full week worth of an advantage for a team that has a few guys banged up.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's huge for Golden State if they can do that. I think you're completely right there because the Celtics
needed seven games to get through the Bucks series, which was basically, that was a rock fight. Like, just like such a physical series. And now they're dealing with the same thing in Miami Heat, like completely physical series. I think these guys are going to be beat up and gassed by the time they get to the NBA finals. I'm expecting the Celtics to win, but the fact that the series is 2-2, like when it maybe should be, you could argue the series could be over already, or 3-1 in favor of Boston. You know, I think by the time they get to the NBA finals, yeah, if you're going up against a fresh Golden State Warriors, that's a recipe for disaster for like the first two games.
Right, right. I think Golden State is smart enough to recognize that, you know, having been through this before. We talked about the success of the Mavs role players, especially the shooting in round two against Phoenix, and kind of questioned whether or not that would carry over to the conference finals. It has not carried over, suffice it to say. Ironically, Brunson, Finney-Smith, and Doncic, who I think Finney-Smith had a good shooting series in round two, but Doncic and Brunson didn't shoot it all that well from three against the Suns. They're both north of 40%. They're playing fine. You know, the Brunson, Doncic, Dinwiddie trio has carried Dallas in this series, but Reggie Bullock, Maxi Kleba, Davis Bertans, those guys are shooting 33%, 14%, and 13% respectively from three in this series. And I mean, that was an all-time no-show by the supporting cast. You know, outside of those three guys, Brunson, Dinwiddie, and Luka, who accounted for 86 of the 100 points on the map side Sunday night. I mean, we saw a similar no-show, I feel like, from the Bucks in game seven, you know, around Giannis against Boston, but Giannis himself also didn't play that well. So it didn't really feel that bad. I mean, you could argue, I think, like I said to Jeff on the radio today, if the Mavericks got even like a D or a D plus game out of their role players, they win game three, but they got an F minus out of the rest of those guys.
Oh yeah. Cause they lost by nine. Reggie Bullock goes 0 for 10 from the field, you know, 10. Kleber 0 for 5 from the field. So yeah, I mean, in a normal situation, like those guys are combining for what, 3-4 3 pointers. And then at obviously least, that's the difference. Yeah, it is tough to have faith in these guys. Ironically, because they were able to, like the past two series, they were playing so well. I mean, so you have to give credit to the Warriors, I think, right? Like, it's not like I've been high on, it's not like I've been the highest on the Mavs role players, right? When they traded Porzingis, I'm like, well, these guys, you know, Doncic is, maybe the system makes sense around Doncic, but these guys aren't actually that good. But, they were playing so well the first two rounds that I think at this point you have to, yeah, just tip your cap to Golden State and how they've been able to limit them.
Yeah, I mean, Golden State really on both ends deserves a lot of credit. They're shooting 53.1% from the field as a team. They're at 39% from three as a team. And you're limiting Dallas to 41% from the field and 32.6% from three. So I think part of it is Dallas probably played a little over its level, especially some of the shooting games that it had against Phoenix. You know, Torian Finney-Smith had eight threes in one of those games. And I want to say that game was still fairly close. Like that was one where if he doesn't go off, Phoenix maybe steals it and the series is totally different. So I think Dallas, you know, maybe inflated its reputation a bit against Phoenix, but yeah, a lot of credit has to go to Golden State because I think it felt like it was almost becoming a trendy pick to take the Mavericks like in six games in this series after beating Phoenix. And it turns out that maybe Golden State has just been the most consistent team all along.
Yeah. I mean, I had some reservations about the Warriors just because, you know, that first round against the Nuggets, it's not like they won those games by a lot towards the end, right? Like they came out pretty hot in the first two games of that series, but the final three games of that Nuggets series were all close, despite the lack of talent on Denver. And then they end up going against the Grizzlies. No Ja Morant. They got outscored, the Warriors did, in the non-Ja Morant game. So I'm like, what has Golden State really actually proved through these first two rounds? Well, on the other hand, the Mavericks, I think, proved a ton in the first two rounds. But, ultimately, the Warriors are the better all-around team. And, you know, their scheme, it's going to win out here.
All right. That was like 6 minutes on a game that is happening in 2 hours. So we'll move along to Celtics Heat. I think that was the right amount. This series... Yeah, I know you were just on VSiN about a half hour ago before we hopped on here talking with Stormy about this series. And she said, you know, how frustrating is it as a fan to watch these games? And you feel like, you know, last night, for example, I was working out after work, got a quick workout in. I'm like rushing home from the gym to catch the start of the game. And I sit down and like 2 minutes in, I'm like, why? I could have stayed another hour. Like, why did I even come home for this? And it's kind of felt like that's how every game in this series so far has gone. And there's been a lot of them, even looking back through rounds one and two throughout the playoffs. You know, not every game is going to come down to the final minute, but I mean, we've had some extreme blowouts where, you know, even though Boston on Saturday night was able to claw back into that game, you never really felt like they were going to win it. Miami always held control. It got a little dicey there for a bit in the second half. But, you know, we've seen such extremes, whether it's in the first quarter over the last two games or in the third quarter of game one of this series, where one team is just so dominant for 12 minutes that it makes the rest of the game just really seem like it doesn't matter.
Right. I've had the same experience as you where I've like gone to work out or gone to the grocery store and I'm like, oh, I'll catch a second half or something. And then I get home and it's like, oh, well, Celtics up by 25. Why even turn it on? But yeah, I mean, I think part of this has been like, you know, the guys have missed time. Like Smart's only played in two games. You know, Rob Williams has played in three. Derek White's only played in three. You got injuries. You know, obviously, Hero missed the last game. Like injuries have been a big part of the series, but now I feel like it's completely I feel like Boston, despite this being a 2-2 series lead, everybody's talked about like how many quarters Boston has won, right? They've won all but like two quarters, I think, or something like that in this series.
I actually looked this up. I looked this up yesterday. I think this was before this game. They had won, I think, 9 of 12 quarters. They had won or tied 9 of 12 quarters.
Right. But I feel like at this point they're in the driver's seat, mostly because I feel like Miami is just, I think the injuries are just piling up like way too much for them. Butler was not right last game at all. Hero missed last game. He's not going to be healthy, I think, even when he comes back. Lowry can't shoot a basketball or play more than like 25 minutes. You have PJ Tucker not 100% either. So I feel like at that point, like, if you can't, you know, Bam had his one game, right, where he looked amazing. And then the Celtics were like, what if we make this one small adjustment? And then he goes back to taking like five shots.
Yeah.
Very bizarre, but I feel like it's, I just can't imagine the Heat winning this series at this point.
I don't know if I go that far. I mean, it's ironic because Boston has been just as injured. I feel like, you know, but Marcus Smart has missed two games in the series. He missed one in the Milwaukee series. They're 2-1 without him. They're 2-1 without him. Two blowouts by 20 plus points, and then the loss in game one, which they controlled outside of that disastrous third quarter. So it feels like Boston's banged up. You know, they were without Horford for that game. You know, Robert Williams has been in and out, but they kind of seem to not miss a beat. You know, as long as Tatum is out there and Brown is out there, they seem like they're going to be fine. Whereas, yeah, last night, I mean, Miami, they started 0-14 from the field, barely got to double digit points in the first quarter. It was clear that not only were they missing Hero, but quite a few guys were not at 100%. I still don't think they're out of this, though. I mean, they do have home court. They're coming back home for game five. This feels weirdly a lot like the Milwaukee series to me, in that, you know, Miami has controlled the series so far. They won game one, they won game three. You know, they've always been the team that can, quote unquote, can lose a game and it's not that big of a deal. But you still kind of feel like Boston's a better team. You still feel like you trust them to put it all together. And it's funny because the odds for this series, you know, kind of mirrored the odds for the Milwaukee series, where, you know, it took Milwaukee winning multiple games in the series for people to finally say, you know, maybe they should be favored. Like the odds always indicated that all things equal, Boston is the better team. And that's what we're seeing yet again here. And it kind of feels like we're headed toward a similar result in that Milwaukee series, where I think Miami could get one of the next two, but if it comes to a game seven, Boston is still the team that I trust more.
Yeah. I mean, you're right in that both teams have been dealing with injuries. I think my concern is that if Jimmy Butler is actually this hurt, then it's over. Right? I mean, that's the difference. It's like Jason Tatum's not hurt for the Celtics. Jalen Brown's not hurt for the Celtics. Al Horford's still out there. Mm-hmm. If Jimmy Butler is really this hurt, then I don't think, and same with Tyler Hero. I mean, they need Tyler Hero to score like 15 a game, like consistently. And Oladipo has been good, right? Like Oladipo has been stepping up and that's important. And maybe that can save them for a game or two. But when you're getting like 7 points out of Kyle Lowry, and it's just like, I don't know how they're going to generate offense if Butler is really playing at like 60% or something.
Yeah, that's the biggest difference. I mean, if you want to say Butler is their equivalent to Jason Tatum, you know, if Jason Tatum is playing at 60%, you're going to be in trouble if you're Boston. But for the second straight series too, Miami just can't shoot. They can't shoot the three.
No.
You know, a lot of the role players who struggled against Philly are struggling again, and you can get away with it against a Philly team that was injured and all out of sorts. But this Boston team, I mean, you're really not going to be able to get away with shooting around 30% from three. And I think thanks to Duncan Robinson knocking in a couple in garbage time, they're up closer to 33% now, but they were hovering around 30% coming into that game. You know, Max Strus had a disastrous showing last night. Gabe Vincent, you know, been hot and cold. Jimmy Butler, not even though the numbers look okay in the playoffs, like not really ever someone you're going to trust from three. He is one of seven in this series. All those role players, like it felt like Miami was maybe the deepest team in the league, partially because they were pulling guys out of nowhere. You know, Strus and Vincent being number one and number two in that category. I mean, Strus was so good that, you know, the guy they're paying $90 million was just out of the rotation and still kind of is. And a lot of those guys have just kind of fallen back down to earth at the wrong time.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think Miami has some problems in terms of, like, they aren't a very good – like, they have guys who are individual guys, like Strus, great from three, right? Hero can get hot. When Duncan Robinson's allowed to play, he can shoot the three. But it's like their spacing isn't very good because Adebayo doesn't shoot threes, and Butler, you're not scared of him from the three-point line, so you have two non-spacers out there. And then – you know, then they're not getting, they don't really get to the free throw line a ton either. And so it's like they're, you know, like they can't take advantage of the switches because Bam can't like do that much in the post. Like he did, you know, again, he did in the previous game, but then it just fell right back to earth. And it's like, if you can't shoot efficiently, can't get to the free throw line and are basically getting out rebounded, tough to win a series.
Yeah. So looking at the odds for the series right now, it's Boston minus 175, Miami plus 145. That's, you know, it is 2-2, so we have to remember that, but that's not tilted as in favor of Boston as I'd have expected.
No, I mean, I would take that. I would take that minus 170 just because, again, I can't trust Miami. But yeah, I mean, you never know because, I mean, Miami has a home court advantage if it goes to a game seven, right? And that's huge. And you figure if it goes to a game seven, that means Butler's been healthy. Right. You know,
you unleash Haslam.
Exactly. Yes. You send Udonis Haslam. Udonis Haslam is going to get better numbers than Bam Adebayo. Yeah. So I can understand someone like wanting to, you know, entertain the idea that the Heat, but I just don't think those odds are good enough. Like if it was plus 200, plus 250, sure, I'd be like, okay, yeah, like let's, yeah, you know, let's do it, but not plus one, what, 40, did you say?
Yeah. I find myself going like swinging wildly back and forth between how I feel about a lot of these teams. And it happened in the earlier rounds too, like way more than I want to. But when you like some of these results have just been so shocking and so stark that, you know, after watching Boston collapse in that third quarter of game one, you're like, how could they possibly win the series? But then you see him come back and blow out the Heat in game two. And you're like, man, Miami's actually terrible. And then Miami comes out with a huge first quarter at Boston and blows Boston out of the water in game three. And then you're back to saying, oh, maybe Boston doesn't quite have enough. You know, Miami's tougher. How are they going to stop Bam? And then Bam goes for 9 points in 28 minutes in game four. Like nothing, there's just no consistency, especially with these two teams. But this series has been, it's been so hard to read. I really feel like I'm going into every game saying like, I know one of these teams is going to be up 40 to 10 at the end of the first quarter, but I have no idea which one it is.
Yeah. You really have to like try to take a step back and, you know, kind of like look at the teams as a whole. Like you have to kind of get rid of these like extreme individual results and just kind of look at on the aggregate what's happening and what these teams look like. Take out a lot of the garbage time. You know, I think that's a huge part of it too when you start looking at these numbers. It's like
70% of the series has been garbage time.
Well, exactly, right? And like, so, you know, at least there's like, if you use cleaning the glass, for example, if you use that site, they filter out garbage time. So you're actually getting like real numbers on what's happening in these series. You know, it'll be like, we filter out the last 8 minutes of this game because there were no starters and, you know, the game was not within 15 points. So you can gain some insights from that. But yeah, it's hard to like, you know, because playoffs is chess moves anyway, right? You expect some like big games out of teams because they make a pretty extreme chess move and it works out and some teams hit some threes. But when it's just constant, it's hard to even know what you're looking at sometimes.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
So we got a tweet out of nowhere from Shams Charania of The Athletic last week that essentially implying that the NBA is very much moving forward with plans to implement an in-season tournament that would likely begin with the 23-24 season. So 2 seasons from now. Usually when we get news like this, it means that it's almost for sure going to happen. Yeah. Very rarely does a report like this come out and then nothing comes of it. If it gets this far, chances are it's going to happen. But still, a long runway for this. You know, again, nothing's imminent for next season. But the goal would be to have this presumably midway through the 2023-24 season. However, we have no details on what this tournament will look like. So you know, we don't have like a ton of hard facts or really any facts to discuss here. But I just want to ask, like, one, what is your initial thought on this idea? Obviously, it's not a new idea. It's something that's been around for a long time. It's been tossed around as a possibility. But before we get into what this could look like, what we'd want it to look like, are you pro or against adding an in-season tournament? Just the overall concept of it.
I'm pretty agnostic about it in general, but I would say if I had to lean, I'd say against, partially because it feels like a little unnecessary. Like, I don't know. I think the NBA, they're in a mentality of like the regular season is broken, right? Like, the players don't think the games matter, et cetera, et cetera. And I get that. Or like, you know, fans, you know, the ratings are down and like nobody's watching Orlando, Charlotte, you know, in the middle of like November or whatever. And it's like, are people going to watch Orlando and Charlotte because it's a midseason tournament in January? Like, I don't know. How about you?
Yeah, I feel the same way. If I had to say, you know, if I had to cast a vote, are you for or against it? I guess I would say against it. But we also have to consider where we stand as like, you know, the 0.1% of people who like follow the NBA day to day. Like I got into the NBA because, you know, I like just how it's run. I like the league. You know, there's a lot of like kind of nostalgia stuff that you think about. And the idea of implementing something that's a pretty major shakeup, really something that the NBA or you know, most American pro sports hasn't really seen. It feels a little gimmicky to me on the surface. Yeah. It feels unnecessary. But you also have to remember that, you know, we are not the audience that the NBA is worried about. You know, where they're worried about pulling in the more casual fans. Like they want to be on the NFL level where, you know, you're pulling in people who really don't necessarily even watch sports or wouldn't consider themselves sports fans, but they're going to tune in to watch a Packers game because of the implications, you know. And obviously the NBA is never going to get to that level, I don't think, in America, but I also think that they're willing to try things like this. And it feels unnecessary to me. It feels like, you know, this kind of alleged downturn in viewership and like, you know, kind of this belief that the league maybe hit its peak around like the Warriors Cavs 2016, 2017. And it's been a little bit of a decline since then. You could quibble about whether that's true or not, but to me, I think the league is in better shape than people seem to think. I think the pandemic messed up a lot of things. And once all that standardizes, I think the league is going to kind of go back to normal. So, you know, forcing something like this through as kind of a short-term band-aid, I assume, to try to recoup some of the money that was lost during the pandemic. Like, I don't know. I don't love it. But at the same time, it's not something that's going to like radically change the league. You know, if at worst, it's just, okay, that was a little weird. Hopefully it doesn't have too many implications for like who wins the actual finals.
Yeah. And I mean, I think part of it too, well, I just like, I want to know if we're going to end up with more games now.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, if you're adding, presumably each team is playing at least one game. If not, you know, to make this worth it, you would think there'd be a way for teams to play, you know, two or three games.
Like a loser's bracket or something, maybe.
Yeah, I think you have to eliminate some regular season games, right? I mean, it's hard to say how many. And this is also going to lead to a situation. If it's quote, an in-season, mid-season tournament, you know, that implies that some teams are going to play more games than others. So are we going to end up with a situation where, whether you're cutting regular season games or not, like, are the teams that make it all the way to the final of the mid-season tournament, are those teams going to end the season with 84 games played, and teams that lose in the first round are going to end with like 77 games played?
Yeah, I mean, I'd be shocked if the rounds, assuming they would be more than like three games, right? You can't do like a five-game best of five series for a mid-season tournament, I don't think. I mean, my guess is they'll just bump it up against the All-Star break. Like, it'll be the mid-season tournament, and then when that ends, that gets the All-Star break.
I was thinking about that, but in that case, do you have to move the All-Star break up due to timing, or does it really matter if this is right in the middle of the season versus closer to the two-thirds mark?
I don't know. I think it's a fair question. Like, do you want this before or after? I think you have to ask, do you want this before or after the All-Star break, or do you want this before or after the trade deadline? Mm-hmm. Do you want to have a mid-season tournament before the trade deadline? Does that make sense?
It could kind of go either way, right? Where you could say like, well, because we did so bad in the mid-season tournament, we need to make a trade.
Well,
or if you do it after, then it's
right.
We're loading up for the mid-season tournament. It totally depends what the incentives are.
Yeah.
If it's just money for the players, I don't really see this catching on all that much. I don't think the players, I mean, unless we're talking like exorbitant amounts of money, I don't think it's really going to matter to these guys who are already making a ton of money and are, you know, seemingly willing to throw it around contract wise, you know, a little more willy nilly than other sports. The question is, so what is on the line here? Is it, you know, I know like Simmons and Russillo were talking about the possibility of like luxury tax relief, or, you know, extra money for your end of the bench roster spots, or a trade exception, something like that. To me, that seems, I kind of like that idea, but I think that's tough to sell to the public, right? If the whole point of this is like generating public interest in the NBA, you know, are you kicking it to commercial with like a trade exception is on the line here tonight in this championship game? You know, like, I think you need a little more pageantry. Like, there has to be like a briefcase of money, or, you know, does each win count for two wins on your actual record? Like, it has to be something, I think, that's a little easier for the average fan to follow.
Yeah, that kind of stuff. I was like, I don't think they're going to do that. Those two guys brought up like quote unquote super wins
as well, right? Which I think makes a little more sense. Or maybe
I don't think you could do like a first round bye situation if you won the midseason tournament, or you start their first playoff series up 1-0. Like, that might be too crazy.
Yeah. I don't want this to mess with the actual playoffs.
Right.
Right. So, yeah, other than like extra wins and money, or like weighted wins, I should say, weighted wins and money, I don't know what the incentive would be. And I don't know. I think, you know, if you're pulling back the amount of regular season games, I don't think there necessarily has to be incentives, because it's not like, hey, you're playing more games now. It might be like, well, we're going to play 68 games now. And then, you know, the average team is going to end up playing 10 midseason tournament games. So you're basically playing the same amount of games. And then there's the play-in tournament as well. So those teams will get up to, 85 games or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm very interested to see what the overall format is. You're like, are they picturing more of an NCAA tournament type of thing, where it's just a quick, you know, this thing could be done in a matter of, you know, 4 days, where you're going from, you know, you're obviously, you'd have to factor in some buys given the number of teams. But, you know, you're condensing this field very quickly. Or is it something where you start with like a pool play round, and then you get your seeds, and you move into this, and you're playing, you know, are you playing back to backs? That's another thing. Like, there's just so many factors here. And, you know, if you go the route of, I know it's been discussed, you know, informally in the past, of does the winner like automatically get a playoff spot or something like that? You know, you lock yourself in no matter what, you get a playoff spot. I feel like there's a route, depending on where they go, where this ends up leading to more issues with like players taking games off and whatnot. You know, like if you're a team in first place, and let's say you're like the 2017 Warriors and this is happening, you know, you're in first, you blow through the play-in tournament and you get, you know, two wins per win there. So all of a sudden you're up like 15 games on the rest of the Western Conference. Like,
right.
Is that really going to incentivize you to play your best players the rest of the way? I think there's a lot of competing factors here where if the NBA wants to reward these teams, but you don't want to create a system where they're rewarded so much that it devalues the remainder of the regular season, because the whole point is to keep these guys incentivized. You know, that is one criticism of the league that I'll agree with, is that it truly does feel like the regular season has been greatly devalued just in the last few years.
Yeah. Well, what are you supposed to do? There's 82, 82 regular season games. That's a lot.
Yeah.
Just in terms of like what it means, you know, it's like, it's not like football, right? Football, they play, 17 now? 17. Like every game, it's like, it means a lot. Like basketball, you know, 3-4 games a week. It's just, I don't know, man. They don't feel that impactful. I mean, it's more impactful than like baseball, where it's like, you know, it's like very little every regular season game, but I don't know, man. I don't know.
I'm interested just to see what the details are. You know, I'm willing to give this a chance. I will not go into, I promise, hold me to this when we're doing podcast in like September of 2023. And I promise that I will be optimistic. I will be open to it. Maybe it's going to be great. You know, maybe it'll be in Vegas. It'll turn into this cool league event. I do like the idea of rolling it into the All-Star break, kind of making this the featured attraction. You know, maybe the All-Star break is 2 weeks. But then of course you run into disadvantages of like, would a team deem it more valuable to get the 2-week break and just lose on purpose right away than winning this whole thing? Like, I don't know. I don't know. I mean, we haven't mentioned like lottery implications, pick implications. Right. I think the catch with that, and again, this is all, they're very minute details here that will determine all this, but the catch with rolling lottery picks and stuff into this is you have players who are, you know, playing for themselves, but also for the franchise, you know, I guess. So like, if you're like the 12th man on the Miami Heat and winning this play-in tournament means that, you know, you guarantee yourself like a top 10 pick in the NBA draft, is that good for you? You know, like that means you're bringing in another guy to take your spot. You know, you're like asking the current roster to help the future roster, which is not necessarily going to be the same.
Yeah, that's tough. I mean, I think ideally the NBA would love to like have the loser's bracket. Like if you win the loser's bracket or something, sure, then you get like higher odds in the lottery. You know, hey, let's make these bad teams try to be competitive, sort of a thing. Mm-hmm. I'm sure they'd love to do that, but I agree. There is sort of competing interest for some of the guys.
All right, yeah, that was all over the place. We'll keep talking about this as we get more details. There's so many directions that this could go. It's hard to, right, kind of have like a sanctioned conversation on where something this abstract is heading. I want to get your thoughts on the NBA draft lottery. We're almost exactly a full week removed now from that happening last Tuesday. We were mid steak league dinner in Madison at the time that the lottery happened. Luckily, we were able to stream it on very sketchy phone service over at the Tornado Room. Guys need to get on that. But we get the Magic at number one, the Thunder at number two, the Rockets at number three, Sacramento 4, and Detroit 5. This feels like kind of a more classic lottery. You know, there's no like weird team crashing the top five. Like these top five are definitely bad teams that have been bad for a while. It feels like these are like the five teams that you would put in the lottery if everything went normally. So we saw Detroit drop down a little bit. We saw Sacramento jump up technically three picks, but you know, I saw that the Kings jump up to four. I'm like, how are they not in the top four anyway? You know, like it kind of seemed like they were in that bottom group. So at the end of the day, you know, it's a little weird seeing Indiana at six, a team that's like almost never in the lottery. You know, you have the Blazers at seven. They've been a playoff team. You have a playoff team this year in New Orleans at eight. But overall we have bad teams, very much in need of talent at the top.
Yeah, the Kings were only four wins out of the play-in tournament, to put that into perspective.
Yikes. That's on the Lakers more than them.
That is very true. Yeah, I mean, this is I do like this lottery because it is helping the young teams continue to build. Orlando's getting a little interesting. They just keep stacking guys at this point. Like, it doesn't even, you know, obviously that they've been tanking or just haven't been good for a while, but I feel like they're putting together something interesting. Cole Anthony's look good. You got Wagner, the Wendell Carter Jr. contract. I don't know if they're like that committed to him. Suggs, I still have some hope for. I think them getting the number one pick is really interesting because they are putting together a pretty nice young team.
Yeah, they're in a spot where it doesn't feel like there's a ton of pressure there. You know, like, they've done a good job stockpiling like players who everybody feels good about, but they're still missing the guy. You know, like, they need their they need their Cade Cunningham or Anthony Edwards or, you know, I don't know, whatever, any star player X who's under 25 years old. Like, they still need that guy. And I think the hope is that if you take Chet Holmgren, it could be him. If you take Jabari Smith, maybe it could be him. But it's going to be really interesting to see if they do, you know, for a team that like, they're one of those teams that doesn't really have like a clear need. It's like, you could pencil in like Anthony, he's their point guard. Suggs, he's the shooting guard of the future. Yeah, Wagner on the wing. You know, maybe Isaac, depending on whether or not you think he's ever coming back. And then if not, you have the Carter Bamba duo, which worked out relatively okay this past season. So like, they're the rare team picking number one that doesn't really have a clear need. But, you know, one thing you would think on paper they don't need is to add yet another like long armed big man. You know, I didn't even mention Chuma Okeke. And if you think Isaac's coming back, like, that's a guy who, you know, contract wise is a big part of your future. So like, on paper, I don't know that it makes sense to add Chet Holmgren, but they're also the team that it would be number one on the list of teams that would love to have Chet Holmgren based on the other players that they've drafted. So I think they probably take him. I mean, the way that the draft is breaking down, unless we see Jaden Ivey or Shaedon Sharpe or Dyson Daniels, like, really shoot up the boards in the next month, like, they're really, you're picking between three power forward slash centers, essentially, in Holmgren, Jabari, and Vaquero. So in some ways they're kind of locked into doing that. So if I'm Orlando, I'm just taking the highest upside player because no matter what, there's going to be some positional overlap there.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, I mean, again, I like Carter's on a movable contract. I think teams would still be interested in Bamba at the right price, as far as like a backup big. So it's like, yeah, you shouldn't worry about the positions because, again, like you mentioned, it's just like, you know, like, Cole Anthony doesn't project as a number one option. Neither does Franz Wagner. Neither really does Jalen Suggs. I don't know what you're doing with Markelle Fultz at this point, but he's not going to be a number one option for your team. So, yeah, just take someone that you hope you can sort of turn into a number one guy or maybe even a number two guy and work the rest out later. Yeah.
But it's a good spot to be because, like, for example, contrast it with Golden State in 2020. You know, there was a lot of pressure to nail that pick. And yet here we are. They completely botched it, we think. I mean, Wiseman has given them nothing, literally played zero games this year, and they're still going to probably end up in the NBA Finals because they're the Warriors. But there, you know, there was a lot of pressure on, like, this is the guy. Like, we need to hit this. You know, I mean, imagine if James Wiseman was as good as Evan Mobley. Like, that was very much in the cards when he was drafted. Like, imagine what this team would look like if they got anything out of that guy. But there was a lot of pressure on that pick to bridge the gap between eras. When you're a team like Orlando, you know, like, obviously there's still pressure on the front office to get a really good player with the number one overall pick, but, you know, it's not like they're not concerned about winning games in 2022 at all. So you don't really need to get this, like, guy who fits with the rest of your roster. I think it's just like, acquire the best talent, figure it out after that. To some degree, I think OKC and Houston are in that same spot. Although, ironically, OKC, despite, you know, bottoming out as much as possible, like, you could argue that they have the most talent in place out of any of these top three teams.
Yeah. Yeah. OKC, they're super flexible and they have a guy, right? And Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, who, I mean, I'm pretty high on SGA, but I think he projects as like a number one or two. And so it's like, you have enough, you can do something with this pick. You could try to trade it. You have Dort. Like, is he a huge, you know, future part of your team? Like, I think they can kind of, they could probably be competitive if they win all in for stuff. If you want to keep building slow, yeah. If it just doesn't work out, then you move SGA for more and you just keep rolling it over. It's good to be in that spot, but you just don't want to run into a situation like the Celtics did where it's like, yeah, you have a ton of these picks, but they just end up all being like, you just draft a ton of guys where it's like, two out of every 10 are hits. You know, you want to be able to, you don't want to hang on to all of these picks too long and never go in.
I know you're not quite as deep in the weeds yet on digging into, you know, the prospects in this class, but in general, you know, just, you know, the concept of Chet Holmgren as the, you know, the highest upside player in this draft, the guy who I think both, you know, even, there are a lot of people who like Jabari Smith and think he's going to go number one. I don't know, at the DraftKings Sportsbook for a long time, he was the favorite to be picked number one, and he still is. He's minus 140. So there's a very, very real possibility that Chet is not the number one pick. But I think most would admit that if you said, take these three guys, if everything goes right, who's the best player? It's definitely Holmgren. If you're OKC and you're of that belief, you know, they seem to be one of those front offices that, you know, when they find a guy they believe in, like, they're willing to go get him. And maybe that means taking him over, you know, taking Giddy over Kuminga last year, you know, was kind of crazy at the time. If you're OKC, do you consider dipping into this war chest of assets that you have over the next 10 years to try to move up to number one if you get the indication that Orlando would be fine landing any of those top three guys?
I mean, if you feel really strongly about someone, I think you should just do it. Especially, again, if you're in the position like OKC where you have so many picks. As far as the concept of Chet Holmgren being the number one guy, I don't know, man. I feel like I'm a little bit on the outside because I don't, like, sit down and watch full, you know, NCAA games very often. But I feel like whenever, you know, like, if someone's posting a clip or clips or a highlight reel of Holmgren, I'm going to watch it, right? Like, I'm at least that engaged. Mm-hmm. And I feel like every time I watch him, not every time, but there's a lot of times where it's like, you know, they're you're posting a highlight of, like, someone doesn't box him out and he comes in for a putback dunk, or he's just, like, swatting some, like, 6'4" guy who just tossed up some, like, underhand layup. Like, I feel like I'm not watching, like, it just, to me, it doesn't feel like I'm seeing a lot of, like, true, like, NBA moves. Like, and that's basically what I'm looking for if I'm watching highlights of guys. Like, is that an NBA move? Did he make someone who was trying extremely hard and I believe is talented look stupid? I feel like I'm just not seeing that from him. And that combined with, like, his frame concerns me a lot. Like, is he bigger at all than Bol Bol, who, like, cannot play in the NBA? I'm serious. Like, Bol Bol cannot play in the NBA. He's too skinny. Is Chet Holmgren bigger than him? No.
I that would actually be a really interesting, like, lineup. I think Bol Bol is probably taller than Holmgren. I think Holmgren might have, like, a little bit of thickness on Bol, but not, it's not, I mean, it's close. It's very, very close. It's probably the closest, like, body to body comparison out there. I'm telling you though, man, like, the best thing to happen to Holmgren is Giannis's physical transformation, because people are going to say, like, Giannis was just that skinny and look at him, he added weight. And look, that's probably not realistic for him to get that big. But he's going to add weight at some point. Like, I'm definitely a believer in the concept of Chet Holmgren. there are going to be some, wherever he ends up, there are going to be some big time lows as a rookie. You know, there are going to be games where, much like Akinzaga, you know, he's got three fouls in, like, 4 minutes of action. You know, he's going to be a target. Like, he's going to get pushed around like crazy as a rookie. But I still think long-term, you know, having watched a lot of Jabari Smith, having watched a lot of Banchero, like, if you're telling me I get to keep this guy for the next, you know, 4 to 8 years, that is for sure the guy I want. Would I pick him to win rookie of the year? No, definitely not. I think he's going to struggle, but I think long-term he's going to be really good.
Yeah, I mean, he does kind of feel like, I mean, as long as you're, you know, banking on the idea of him like adding sufficient weight, it's like, what's his absolute worst case scenario? Like, a Miles Turner who can run in transition and pass a little bit, like a 3-and-D kind of center, very modern. So, like, that, like, his game I like a lot, and I think his game is really interesting. I have a hard time separating when I see him go up against, like, some unranked college team and, like, blow past some, like, kid in transition. I'm like, yeah, like, that's what he's supposed to do. Like, you know, like, he's talented and he's tall. Like, so I don't know. It's hard for me. Right. It's just, I think he's polarizing for a very good reason.
It's hard when there's not a template. You know, we've really not seen a guy like this. And like I told James a couple weeks ago, like, I think the fact that he's white, it just, like, breaks everybody's brains. It seriously does. Like, people are just like, I don't know what to do with this.
Maybe. Yeah. Yeah, it's tough too, because there is still a lot of, you know, there still is a lot of college basketball being played that is not like NBA basketball. There's like two bigs on the floor. There's a center who's 6'7". They're trying to feed the post. They just like can't do it. You know, no 3 seconds, right? He's not gonna be able to camp the lane like he does in college a lot. You know, so I think that's tough as well. And it's just like, you know, he doesn't, you know, it's like people compare him to Giannis, right? And like, it's a completely different situation from like where Giannis came from and like the exposure that was on him. But the Bucks took Giannis like in the middle of the lottery. Like they took him at what, like 14th or something. So yeah, it feels a little different to me. You know, and I think Holmgren has shown more than Giannis did, obviously. But you know, and I was wrong about Trae Young. I thought Trae Young would struggle. He struggled early on in his rookie career. He's ended up being one of the better point guards in the NBA. But I'm just like not, I'll be that guy who's just like not sold on Holmgren, and then he'll be amazing. And I'll be like, I can't believe this is happening. Number one pick, one of the best college players in the game. I'll be like, this is absolutely shocking to me that he's good.
I said he wasn't going to be good. How was he good?
Yeah.
All right. Last thing I want to end on. I said this to you as a topic because I've listened to so many pods and read so many articles over the last couple of weeks. And I just keep hearing this like belief that it's over for the Suns. You know, the West is going to be so much better. The East is, you know, back on top, everything, you know, all these teams are ascending. And I don't even really want to talk about the Suns specifically. I just want to talk about the idea that like seemingly every other team in the league is going to be way better than they were this year. And the Suns, you know, missed their window, which again is probably true. The Suns did probably miss their window. They definitely missed their best 2-year window to win a title, especially when you're up 2-0 in the NBA finals in one of those seasons. But I want to kind of go team by team, especially in the West. And we could talk East too, if we have time. Like how many teams can we say are going to be definitively better next season? Like, or essentially how many of those teams would you put ahead of the Phoenix Suns, assuming they essentially return the same roster? Obviously a lot can happen with DeAndre Ayton. If he walks, yeah, they have to find a replacement. But I kind of like their chances, you know, if like, for example, if they're able to like trade him to Indiana and bring back Miles Turner, I don't know that that's really like the biggest drop off in the world, you know, and Miles Turner is making slightly less money. You know, you're giving yourself a little more flexibility, but that's beside the point. I just want to go team by team and say like, how many teams are for sure going to be much better next season? So Phoenix Suns, I would say, would be probably about the same as their best case scenario, right? Like they're not going to be better than 64 wins.
No, I think they'll be better. They'll be the same or worse.
Yeah,
I think,
same or worse. Yeah. Probably worse.
Yeah. Okay. It's just Ayton's a maybe, Chris Paul's older, stuff like that.
The Memphis Grizzlies, 56 wins. Do they top 56 wins next year?
I mean, like in theory they should, right?
Yes. That's a lot of wins.
I mean, calling like Memphis a 60, basically you're saying Memphis is a 60 win team next year. I don't know, man. I don't know. I'm not ready to go there. So same, possibly worse.
Right. Golden State.
Yeah, Golden State should probably be better, right? You get a full season of healthy Clay. Kuminga's better. Moody's better. Maybe you trade Wiseman for something. I think they should be better next year, actually.
I think they should be as well. You know, then you have to start looking at like the Wiggins contract. I know there's been some talk about like, do they consider, you know, kind of flipping that and parlaying that into, you know, a different piece who, you know, is a little cheaper and maybe fits a similar type of role. They should still be very good. I think the only argument against it is we did see some decline from Curry this year. And, you know, as he goes into his mid-30s, does that become a little more real? Because, you know, if Curry drops off, or even Draymond, you know, if either of those guys are injured or start to decline physically, Golden State could still be really, really good. But I don't know that they'll reach that like borderline unattainable level that really no other team can reach on offense.
Right. But I think the hope for them is like, well, Poole is going to make up for that, and Kuminga, yeah, and like, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Dallas. Is Dallas going to be for sure better?
For sure?
I don't know if they are.
No, not for sure. And they might lose Brunson. And then what?
Yeah. And if you bring him back, then it's like, okay, you're bringing back the same team. Like they don't, they're kind of like Milwaukee in some ways, you know, less advanced version, I guess, of the Bucks, where like, their team is like weirdly kind of locked in right now. You know, like you don't have, yeah, a lot of like movable pieces. You don't have like this stud young guy that you can trade for a different piece. Like it kind of is what it is around Luka.
You know, there is a scenario where their book's empty, empty while Nikola Jokic is a free agent, and if Michael Porter Jr.'s back is that messed up, and they're locked in with him and Gordon and Murray. I'm just saying.
That would be amazing. I wouldn't rule it. I mean, we've seen, I don't know, if LeBron and Chris Bosh and D. Wade could play together, if Stephen Curry and Kevin Durant could play together, I don't think that's out of the question at all. But I don't know. I think Dallas, like, if they're we're at the point now where Luka is in, like, you know, young LeBron, young Durant mode, yeah, where no matter what, you can just pencil him in for 50-plus wins and you figure it out. So I'm not going to say they're going to be worse, but it's not like they have a path to becoming, like, a super team in the summer here. Utah, 49 wins this year. Kind of feels like this might be a blow it up summer for them.
It does, but I kind of wonder if they would rather.
I think when teams, like, everybody's so eager to blow a team up, but I think in reality, most of the owner, the general manager, they would rather shuffle and just try to just shuffle the deck a little bit. And then if it doesn't work, then you blow it up. So for them, maybe they trade Gobert. They experiment a little bit. I don't know what's going to happen with Conley, but they probably will be worse, is my guess. Neutral or worse.
I think that's fair. Yeah, it's hard to say right now, at least. You know, with Donovan Mitchell, you know, it feels like there's a new rumor every week that he maybe wants to go somewhere else. It's hard to say, like, oh yeah, Jazz for sure. They're trending upwards. I think, yeah, best case scenario is they win like 48, 49 games again. Denver at 48 wins. I'm fully willing to say that Denver should be significantly better next year.
100%. You get hopefully MPJ back. You get Murray back, especially. That's
right.
More reliable.
Just Murray alone. Like, even if Porter's back, like, really becomes an issue, and it looks like, you know, it's going to affect his career. Like, just getting Murray back is enough to bump this team up.
Right. It's like Campazzo couldn't even play in the playoffs. So it's like you were throwing him out during the regular season barely. It's like, yeah, it's they'll be better.
So Minnesota, 46-36 on the ascent. You know, even amid questions about, you know, can you really trust Towns? Can you really trust really a lot of these guys in high leverage situations? But 18 fewer wins than the Suns last year. You know, can they close that gap? Probably not. Like, are we looking at Minnesota being like a potential top three team in the West next year?
I don't know, but they should be better. And I also think I think their point differential was better than their, you know, the actual wins that they got. That's part of it too. So you kind of, those two things combined. Anthony Edwards
could just blow up next season and they become a 50 win team just off of his back. You know, if he becomes the best player in Cats, officially your second best player, you're in an amazing spot. And whether or not you believe in D'Angelo Russell as a player or whatnot.
I do not.
Right. But he's still gonna give you decent minutes. So I think they could be trending up. They should be trending up.
Is there anywhere that you could bet the Timberwolves to win the finals at some point in the next 10 years? Are you aware of any books that offer 10-year futures?
No, I am not.
Yeah, I'm highly leveraged on the 2028 finals right now.
Yeah, exactly.
The Clippers. This is another obvious one, kind of Denver. Should be significantly better. But, you know, I think we are getting to the point with Kawhi where, you know, we've talked about this before in the fantasy context. I mean, he's not young. The injuries are adding up. I mean, this is torn quad tendon, torn ACL. You know, certainly fair to wonder how many games he'll play. But if Kawhi's healthy and looks like Kawhi in the playoffs, you know, this team could go 42-40 again, and they're going to be the team that nobody wants to play. So kind of a hard one to gauge.
Well, the good news is that it's impossible for him to be more injured than he was this year.
Yeah,
So I'm going to go over in terms of, or up, or however we're phrasing this. They should be better.
All right, Clippers up, official. the Pelicans, 36-46. Should be better, I think, right? I mean, pretty encouraging.
Encouraging end of the season. Zion hopefully will be playing. You get CJ McCollum. I think that's huge. Like, you just look at their team now. The core of McCollum, Herb Jones, Brandon Ingram, Zion Williamson, Jonas Valanciunas is pretty nice. It's a pretty nice team.
Yeah, no, it really is. It really is. And obviously it's going to hinge on what you get from Zion, what version of Zion, how healthy Zion is. It's going to ultimately determine their series. I mean, if he comes back looking like the guy that we saw, you know, at his peak 2 years ago, I mean, this is a team that has an ultra high ceiling. Still to me, probably not like an actual dark horse title contender next year. I think that would be a pretty big surprise. But, you know, with a guy like Zion, I mean, anything is theoretically possible. Well, we'll try to lump some of these teams at the end here together. I don't think we need to go like, what do you think about the Rockets? Will they be better than 20-62? but the Spurs, the Lakers, the Kings, and the Blazers were like the non like extreme basement teams in the West this past year. All those teams should probably be better. I mean, it's usually hard to be worse when you're winning games in like the 20s and 30s. But again, I don't really see any of these teams with. We always have to put an asterisk next to the Lakers. Like I guess technically they could be a title contender. But I think all these teams are still pretty far away from, you know, challenging for a spot of, you know, the top four or five of the West.
Yeah, no idea about San Antonio. Could still be tanking. Yeah, Lakers should be better. Kings, I have absolutely no faith that that team makes any sense. And then OKC could be anything. So they're a complete wild card.
Yeah, I mean, the Lakers, like I said, are that one team where, I don't know, there have been like miracle trades in the past that have involved the Lakers or have involved LeBron. Like if they could somehow find a way to dump Westbrook and get a reasonable piece back, like it's not insane to think that they could be in the mix, especially with a lot of the power feeling like it's shifting toward the Eastern Conference. But man, I mean, they would need like the ultimate stroke of luck in a team that's like really willing to help out LeBron late in his career for that to happen. I think he just kind of has to go down with the ship for at least one more year, as long as Russ is there.
Yeah. It's if the Mavericks can win 52 games by just like dumping Porzingis and just rolling out with like Brunson and Dinwiddie, it's hard for me to believe the Lakers can't do the same by dumping Westbrook for just pieces that make sense.
Right. I think LeBron really didn't want to have to play that way anymore, you know, of like being the Doncic, Harden, right, you know, even Jokic type, where it's just like, put four role players around me and we're going to win 55 games. Like, I think he still has that in him. I mean, physically, he definitely still does. I think he was just like, I'm sick of playing this way. Like, I don't want the responsibility of doing that for 40 minutes every single night. And that's why they went with the superstar heavy approach. But I don't know, maybe they go back. Maybe LeBron's willing to do that if they can find a taker for Westbrook. Like, the problem is the Lakers have not only the most damaging player in the league on their roster in Russ, but they also have like arguably the worst supporting cast of any team in the league. Like their 4 through 15 guys were atrocious for most of last year.
Yeah. And Anthony Davis isn't staying healthy. So yeah, then it's right. Just like LeBron and a bunch of guys who don't fit with LeBron. So that's, you know, that was fine when he was 24. But now it's, yeah, you're getting, I mean, Malik Monk is like your third best player. So
that's exactly that's a major problem. Like the team that won the title in the bubble, like it's not like they had a superstar supporting cast by any means, but you definitely had guys who fit well around LeBron and fit well around Davis. You know, I mean, Caruso was the consummate guy. You know, LeBron always loved Rondo. Rondo played great in the bubble. Danny Green, KCP, like all those guys are gone. You know, they basically punted on all of the valuable role players in order to bring in Westbrook.
Right. And then, yeah, like you mentioned, it's just you punt on the role players and then it's like, I mean, part of the issue is they thought Talen Horton-Tucker was actually going to be good. Right. Because if Talen Horton-Tucker is actually good, it's going to be a little bit different. But like he was fifth on the team in total shot attempts, shot 42% from the field, 27% from three. And everyone else was just like handling the ball instead of him. So it's not like he's racking up a ton of assists or anything either. Yeah.
I think they truly thought Horton Tucker was going to be their Jordan Poole or Tyler Hero type. Like, I think 100%. They really believe that.
Yeah. Cause you can't, getting rid of Caruso makes no sense otherwise. Like you have to really believe that Horton Tucker is like, this is our third/fourth guy. Like, lock it in. But he was not.
Yeah, it's a bit of a clown show. Still no head coach for the Lakers as of late May. But man, yeah. I know we got derailed just going on a Lakers tangent, but I needed this. This was cathartic for me.
You're welcome.
All right, well, long story short, I'm just saying I don't think there's so many overwhelmingly talented teams in the West, even though there are plenty of very good players and very good teams. I don't think it's like 100% doom and gloom for the Suns. You know, I think it's accurate to say there are several teams that are on the rise, but I don't think it's accurate to say that all of a sudden, you know, even if they swap out Ayton for Miles Turner or, you know, whoever would be a slight downgrade from Ayton, I don't think all of a sudden the Suns are just going to be like the seventh best team in the West. And this is the end of it.
No, I think there are just as many teams trending up as trending down. And, you know, there are, I think what people are worried about is that if you move Ayton, there suddenly becomes more scenarios in which this team falls apart.
Sure.
Just because, you know, like I'm not in love with DeAndre Ayton or anything in terms of his game. I wouldn't want to pay him a max contract unless I thought I was maybe going to win the title after doing so. But, you know, it's like, what are you going to do at center? Otherwise, yeah, maybe you trade him for Turner. Chris Paul's another year older, literally cannot stay healthy in the playoffs, cannot get to the rim anymore.
Yeah.
You paid Landry Shamet too much money.
Yeah. He's there, Horton Tucker.
And I'm just saying, and you know, people love Devin Booker. Like, you and I got in a conversation like at the beginning of the playoffs about like Devin Booker's like MVP, finals MVP odds, which I felt like was, I got into the weeds a little bit about like the narrative of who makes the team actually good. Mm-hmm. I'm just like not that in on Devin Booker. Like, I think he's really good. I'm not thinking that he might ever be like Jason Tatum. I don't even know if he's ever going to be as good as Jason Tatum is. I don't know.
I don't think that's a hot take, but I do think it's interesting how quickly this stuff flips, right? Where when Booker's scoring 33 points and the Suns are blowing out the Mavs in game two and look like they're cruising back to another finals, you know, then it's like, man, this guy is amazing. Sky's the limit. He's still so young. But then when he no-shows a game seven at home, you know, we're very quick to just go completely the other way. And honestly, Tatum himself, I think, has gotten that same treatment throughout these playoffs, you know, like where he goes toe-to-toe, beats Durant in four games. And it's like, is he now better than Durant? Like, if you're ranking the best players in the league, do you have to put him ahead of KD? And then, you know, he kind of no-shows game one against the Bucks, and it's like, oh yeah, that's right. He's actually not that good anymore. But then he scores 46 later in the series, and now he's back up to being good. Like, I think it's more a product of just like we're doing our evaluations too often at this point.
Yeah, because to me, Devin Booker and Zach LaVine are not really different players. Like,
not a whole lot different. No, I think there's a little more there with Booker, but he's closer to Zach LaVine than he is to Jason Tatum.
Right.
Or closer to, you know, much closer to a Zach LaVine, DeMar DeRozan caliber of player than he is a Kevin Durant caliber of player. You know, like there's still I think the mistake we make is maybe bringing guys like that and even Tatum at times, like bringing guys like that up into the LeBron, Durant, even Curry type of tier, you know, where we're very willing to say like, man, he's coming up on Durant. When, I mean, Kevin Durant has been that good for, like, you gotta be that good and that consistently good for 5 to 10 years before you start entering that conversation. You know, it can't just be one good playoff series and then it's like, who would you rather have, KD or Tatum?
Right. Yeah. I it's tough because it's all about expectations, right? Like when Devin Booker was leading the team when they were like not winning any games, I was saying like, well, I actually think Devin Booker is pretty good. It's just that he has no help. And now that, you know, Chris Paul kind of became the leader of the team, it's like, well, I think he's good, but he's not like, you know what I mean?
Well, it's like you were right about that. But then what does it say, I guess, about Booker, where it's like, you know, can you be a top 10 player in the league if you absolutely need another guy to be like the most important player?
Yeah, I don't know. There's a lot of nuance in that, but I think it's, you know, I think it's fair. Basically, what I'm trying to get to is I think it's fair to wonder if we get rid of DeAndre Ayton and Chris Paul has any sort of real decline or really misses games. And I know they played well without him, but I don't know. I mean, if the conversation that we're talking about is did they miss their window? Is there a really good chance they missed their window? I think, yeah, there's a decent chance they missed their window. Obviously, I don't think they're completely out of it. But it's none of it's a guarantee.
You know, one thing that when we talk like player evaluations and rankings and stuff, I always remember, I think it was like 2017 or 18, they do like the GM survey. And it was, you know, what player would you most want to start your franchise with? Right. And it was like overwhelmingly Karl-Anthony Towns was like the number one guy that year. And ever since then, he's never even received a vote since that GM survey. Right. Like, it changed that quickly. He was the guy that almost every team would want. And then over the course of one season, everyone decided they were out on him.
Yeah. I mean, was that more of a product of Giannis coming through? I don't even remember
I think it was that. I mean, like, that. Looking at Towns' numbers, it's not like they ever really fell off. I mean, this was before he had the injury season And that might have been around the time that Jimmy Butler came to town and kind of stirred things up. I think it was more so just other players passing them up, which that's not going to change anytime soon with the amount of talent coming into the league. It's like, I mean, you could be a top five player 1 year and then have just a slightly worse year, and all of a sudden you're the 12th best player because there's so much other ascending talent.
Right. And you know, I've always been a talents guy, so I don't think it's like, you know, again, you could be having the conversation. Does he have enough help? Is he more of a number two? Mm-hmm. I don't know. Cause yeah, like second year in the league, he was putting up 25 and 12, shooting like 52, 37, 83. And it's like, well, how are you not going to start your franchise with this guy? He's 21 years old.
It's just, my point, I guess, is that it's really hard to get to the point where you become a year over year consensus guy, you know, like LeBron obviously reached that, but by like 2011, like Kevin Durant was, if you were talking best players in the league, he could not be lower than three, no matter what. And I feel like the rest of these guys just don't have enough resume to fall back on yet, where it's like, I mean, not that anybody was saying Devin Booker is a top three guy, but you know, it feels like his ranking week to week could go, like, could be anywhere as high as like the eighth best player in the league or as low as like the 30th best player in the league. And we're just, you know, we're just judging it by how each game or each week or each series goes. I don't know what to think of him. I don't know. I mean, I liked him a lot until he no-showed the last couple of games of that series.
Yeah, I mean, I think some of it you could use like the accolades almost to kind of guide your conversation, like how many All-NBA teams did this guy make in a row or something like that. And it's like Tatum only has one All-NBA team, although I'm sure he'll get in this year. But you know, I think that's a huge part of it as well.
I think there is something to be said, and this is going to come off as maybe a knock on Booker. I don't really mean it to, but like, I think the guys who are truly transcendent and truly like super, super, super all-time superstars, you know, like Booker had the numbers for the last like several years before Chris Paul showed up, but he wasn't making All-NBA because the Suns are winning 24 games, you know? And I think it's hard to measure, but if you're a good enough or great enough player, your team is just always going to have enough of a baseline that the awards are going to come, you know, like if you're like truly one of the 10 best players in the league, I think it's fair to say that your team can't win 25 games. You know, it's like, if you're that good, your team should automatically be winning 35 plus games.
It seems like that. Yeah. At least, yeah, like 35. Cause if we have this conversation about like the LeBron Lakers, it gets a little, we get a little in the weeds.
God, this was like the most frustrating season for me to watch. I really can't even talk about it. It was really wearing on me around like January, February, during the dog days of the regular season. This is just like ripping open those scabs, but we got to get out of here. You know, we're up over an hour at this point, but good chatting with you as always, man. We kind of hit a bunch of random stuff, but you know, outside of the two playoff series, we're nearing that dreaded like true dead zone in the NBA season. But you know, luckily we have the draft in a little under a month, and then summer league right after that. So you know, the calendar never really stops.